The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. Bleak House. Dickens took some time to arrive at a title for his ninth novel. It was to be unlike any of his previous work. It was to be a novel of purpose. Dickens, at the height of his powers, had a message to convey on a grand scale, and there was to be no central character who would dominate the narrative. So, biographical titles like Oliver Twist or David Copperfield would not be appropriate. Instead, his novel was to reflect the state of England in 1853, a vast undertaking. He finally settled on Bleak House without any explanatory subtitle or additions. This enigmatic title would allow his readers to reflect and apply it as they chose to the contents of the novel, whose projected image of England is indeed, in many ways, bleak. Drawing upon his own experiences within the legal system, as a solicitor's clerk, Dickens attacks the law's delays, particularly in respect of the Chancery Court, where cases could be, and were, argued over for decades. The fictional Jarndyce versus Jarndyce case in this novel was based on the real-life Jennings case, which was before the court for an amazing 90 years. Dickens attacks an outmoded system, deep-rooted in ancient historical practice, that impeded rather than helped humanity, that ultimately destroys what it seeks to assist. A system perpetuated by its workers, the lawyers, for their own benefit, blocking and confusing rather than oiling the wheels of the law. Likewise, another system is scrutinized by Dickens, aristocratic privilege. Still largely feudal in Victorian times, privilege is firmly in place, as epitomized by Sir Leicester Dedlock. But Dickens challenges the rights of the old order by introducing Rouncewell, the ironmaster, whose attitude to Sir Leicester reflects the shifting society of the 1850s, knocking boldly at the door of privilege. Dickens instinctively supported the free will of the individual against any restrictive system of control. Indeed, it would be the theme of his next novel, Hard Times. The insidious presence of the law in Bleak House is represented allegorically by the London fog, with which the book opens so atmospherically, getting everywhere and influencing every character in the book, from the great and haughty Lady Dedlock to the shabby, genteel, bewildered Miss Flight. It distorts images, obscures and hides. The characters in Bleak House are blurred or not what they at first appear to be. The fog, too, is a symbol of the pervasive contamination that corrupts society, crippling poverty, a hide-bound bureaucratic system epitomized by the law, the misguided philanthropy of Mrs. Jellyby seeking to help those abroad whilst ignoring the poor at home, and one of Dickens's key themes, smallpox spread through poor sanitary conditions. His message is that it is inertia that encourages disease to spread, and will eventually overwhelm us all. The disease shows no respect for the class system, the virus transferring from paupers to the middle classes alike. Individual responsibility for one's actions, Dickens states, is a start in making any changes to social injustice. The inaction of Lady Dedlock to set things right has subsequent tragic effects on the lives of Nemo, Joe, and Esther. On a larger scale, Dickens implies that if the tensions of an unequal and unjust society are not attended to, society itself may eventually spontaneously combust, as does one of the characters. Parasites like Skimpole and Turveydrop, and leeches like Smallweed, are contrasted with characters who continually work for good, like Jarndyce, the good-hearted Esther, and Joe, the crossing sweeper, symbolically cleaning the dirty London streets. The story is told by two narrators, a unique feature of Dickens's work. Esther self-effacingly tells her own story, whilst an anonymous voice unravels the mystery of Lady Dedlock's story. Dickens includes a vast range of characters to give a panoramic view of English society from top to bottom, and how the highest and the lowest interact. Such diversity also helped him in the construction of what is essentially a mystery story, a whodunit, where characters and plot strands appear like clues and can just as likely turn out to be red herrings. Bleak House could in fact be called the first detective novel in English literature, as it predates The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, which is often credited to be the first, by 15 years. All the ingredients we associate with the classic fictional detective are in place in the characterization of Bucket. He is enigmatic, single-minded in his pursuit of the criminal, ruthless, and clever. It was a genre that obviously fascinated Dickens, as he explored it further in Our Mutual Friend and the unfinished The Mystery of Edwin Drood. On its publication, Bleak House received considerable criticism from the institutions it attacked, but this did not for one moment damage the book's popularity. It sold twice as many copies as the author's previous success, David Copperfield. In the preface to the first edition of the book, Dickens sounds ecstatic. "I believe I have never had so many readers as in this book. May we meet again."
London and the Fog.
London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire, horses scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill-temper, and losing their foothold at street corners, where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if the day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river, where it flows among green aits and meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights, fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships, fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper down in his close cabin. Fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck. Chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them, as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds. Gas looming through the fog in divers places in the streets, much as the sun may, from the spongy fields, be seen to loom by husbandman and ploughboy. Most of the shops lighted 2 hours before their time, as the gas seems to know, for it has a haggard and unwilling look. The raw afternoon is rawest, and the dense fog is densest, and the muddy streets are muddiest, near that leaden-headed old obstruction, appropriate ornament for the threshold of a leaden-headed old corporation, Temple Bar. And hard by Temple Bar, in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Never can there come fog too thick, never can there come mud and mire too deep, to assort with the groping and floundering condition which this High Court of Chancery, most pestilent of hoary sinners, holds this day in the sight of heaven and earth.
Mrs. Jellyby.
We passed several more children on the way up, whom it was difficult to avoid treading on in the dark, and as we came into Mrs. Jellyby's presence, one of the poor little things fell downstairs, down a whole flight, as it sounded to me, with a great noise. Mrs. Jellyby, whose face reflected none of the uneasiness which we could not help showing in our own faces, as the dear child's head recorded its passage with a bump on every stair, Richard afterwards said he counted 7, besides 1 for the landing, received us with perfect equanimity. She was a pretty, very diminutive, plump woman, of from 40 to 50, with handsome eyes, though they had a curious habit of seeming to look a long way off, as if, I am quoting Richard again, they could see nothing nearer than Africa. "I am very glad indeed," said Mrs. Jellyby in an agreeable voice, "to have the pleasure of receiving you. I have a great respect for Mr. Jarndyce, and no one in whom he is interested can be an object of indifference to me." We expressed our acknowledgments and sat down behind the door, where there was a lame invalid of a sofa. Mrs. Jellyby had very good hair, but was too much occupied with her African duties to brush it. The shawl, in which she had been loosely muffled, dropped onto her chair when she advanced to us, and as she turned to resume her seat, we could not help noticing that her dress didn't nearly meet up at the back, and that the open space was railed across with a latticework of stay-lace, like a summer-house. The room, which was strewn with papers and nearly filled by a great writing-table covered with similar litter, was, I must say, not only very untidy but very dirty. We were obliged to take notice of that with our sense of sight, even while, with our sense of hearing, we followed the poor child who had tumbled downstairs, I think into the back kitchen, where somebody seemed to stifle him. But what principally struck us was a jaded and unhealthy-looking, though by no means plain girl, at the writing-table, who sat biting the feather of her pen and staring at us. I suppose nobody ever was in such a state of ink. And from her tumbled hair to her pretty feet, which were disfigured with frayed and broken satin slippers, trodden down at heel, she really seemed to have no article of dress upon her from a pin upwards that was in its proper condition or its right place. "You find me, my dears," said Mrs. Jellyby, snuffing the two great office candles in tin candlesticks, which made the room taste strongly of hot tallow. The fire had gone out, and there was nothing in the grate but ashes, a bundle of wood, and a poker. "You find me, my dears, as usual, very busy, but that you will excuse. The African project at present employs my whole time. It involves me in correspondence with public bodies and with private individuals, anxious for the welfare of their species all over the country. I'm happy to say it is advancing. We hope by this time next year to have from 150 to 200 healthy families cultivating coffee and educating the natives of Borrioboola Gha on the left bank of the Niger." As Ada said nothing but looked at me, I said it must be very gratifying. "It is gratifying," said Mrs. Jellyby. "It involves the devotion of all my energies, such as they are, but that is nothing so that it succeeds, and I am more confident of success every day. Do you know, Miss Summerson, I almost wonder that you never turned your thoughts to Africa." This application of the subject was really so unexpected to me that I was quite at a loss how to receive it. I hinted that the climate... "The finest climate in the world," said Mrs. Jellyby. "Indeed, ma'am?" "Certainly, with precaution," said Mrs. Jellyby. "You may go into Holborn without precaution and be run over. You may go into Holborn with precaution and never be run over. Just so with Africa." I said, "No doubt." I meant as to Holborn. "If you would like," said Mrs. Jellyby, putting a number of papers towards us, "to look over some remarks on that head and on the general subject, which have been extensively circulated, while I finish a letter I am now dictating to my eldest daughter, who is my amanuensis." The girl at the table left off biting her pen and made a return to our recognition, which was half bashful and half sulky. "I shall then have finished for the present," proceeded Mrs. Jellyby with a sweet smile, "though my work is never done."
Crook's shop.
She had stopped at a shop over which was written Crook, Rag and Bottle Warehouse. Also in long, thin letters, Crook, Dealer in Marine Stores. In one part of the window was a picture of a red paper mill, at which a cart was unloading a quantity of sacks of old rags. In another was the inscription Bones Bought. In another, Kitchen Stuff Bought. In another, Old Iron Bought. In another, Waste Paper Bought. In another, ladies and gentlemen's wardrobes bought. Everything seemed to be bought, and nothing to be sold there. In all parts of the window were quantities of dirty bottles, blacking bottles, medicine bottles, ginger beer and soda water bottles, pickle bottles, wine bottles, ink bottles. I am reminded, by mentioning the latter, that the shop had, in several little particulars, the air of being in a legal neighbourhood and of being, as it were, a dirty hanger-on and disowned relation of the law. There are a great many ink bottles. There was a little tottering bench of shabby old volumes outside the door, labelled Law Books, all at ninepence. Some of the inscriptions I have enumerated were written in law hand, like the papers I had seen in Kenjan Carboy's office, and the letters I had so long received from the firm. Among them was one, in the same writing, having nothing to do with the business of the shop, but announcing that a respectable man aged 45 wanted engrossing or copying to execute, with neatness and dispatch. Address to Nemo, care of Mr. Crook within. There were several second-hand bags, blue and red, hanging up. A little way within the shop door lay heaps of old crackled parchment scrolls and discoloured and dog's-eared law papers. I could have fancied that all the rusty keys, of which there must have been hundreds huddled together as old iron, had once belonged to doors of rooms or strong chests in lawyers' offices. The litter of rags, tumbled partly into and partly out of a one-legged wooden scale, hanging without any counterpoise from a beam, might have been counsellors' bands and gowns torn up. One had only to fancy, as Richard whispered to Ada and me while we all stood looking in, that yonder bones in a corner, piled together and picked very clean, were the bones of clients to make the picture complete. As it was still foggy and dark, and as the shop was blinded besides by the wall of Lincoln's Inn, intercepting the light within a couple of yards, we should not have seen so much but for a lighted lantern that an old man in spectacles and a hairy cap was carrying about in the shop. Turning towards the door, he now caught sight of us. He was short, cadaverous, and withered, with his head sunk sideways between his shoulders, and the breath issuing in visible smoke from his mouth as if he were on fire within. His throat, chin, and eyebrows were so frosted with white hairs, and so gnarled with veins and puckered skin, that he looked from his breast upward like some old root in a fall of snow.
"Hi, hi," said the old man, coming to the door. "Have you anything to sell?"
We naturally drew back and glanced at our conductress, who had been trying to open the house door with a key she had taken from her pocket, and to whom Richard now said that as we had had the pleasure of seeing where she lived, we would leave her, being pressed for time. But she was not to be so easily left. She became so fantastically, impressingly earnest in her entreaties that we would walk up and see her apartment for an instant, and was so bent in her harmless way on leading me in as part of the good omen she desired, that I, whatever the others might do, saw nothing for it but to comply. I suppose we were all more or less curious, at any rate, when the old man added his persuasions to hers and said,
"Aye, aye, please, sir, it won't take a minute. Come in, come in. Come in through the shop if t'other door's out of order."
We all went in, stimulated by Richard's laughing encouragement, and relying on his protection.
"My landlord, Crook,"
said the little old lady, condescending to him from her lofty station as she presented him to us.
"He is called among the neighbours the Lord Chancellor. His shop is called the Court of Chancery. He is a very eccentric person. He is very odd. Oh, I assure you, he is very odd."
She shook her head a great many times and tapped her forehead with her finger to express to us that we must have the goodness to excuse him.
"For he is a little, you know, M," said the old lady with great stateliness.
The old man overheard and laughed.
"It's true enough," he said,
going before us with the lantern,
"that they call me the Lord Chancellor and call my shop Chancery. And why do you think they call me the Lord Chancellor and my shop Chancery?"
"I don't know, I'm sure," said Richard rather carelessly.
"You see,"
said the old man, stopping and turning round,
"they... Hi! Here's lovely hair. I've got 3 sacks of ladies' hair below, but none so beautiful and fine as this. What colour and what texture!"
That'll do, my good friend," said Richard, strongly disapproving of his having drawn one of Ada's tresses through his yellow hand.
"You can admire as the rest of us do without taking that liberty."
The old man darted at him a sudden look, which even called my attention from Ada, who, startled and blushing, was so remarkably beautiful that she seemed to fix the wandering attention of the little old lady herself. But as Ada interposed and laughingly said she could only feel proud of such genuine admiration, Mr. Crook shrunk into his former self as suddenly as he had leapt out of it.
"You see, I have so many things here," he resumed, holding up the lantern, "of so many kinds, And all as the neighbours think, but they know nothing. Wasting away and going to rack and ruin. That's why they have given me and my place a christening. And I have so many old parchments and papers in my stock. And I have a liking for rust and must and cobwebs. And all's fish that comes to my net. And I can't abear to part with anything I once lay hold of, or shall my neighbours think, but what do they know, or to alter anything, or to have any sweeping, nor scouring, nor cleaning, nor repairing going on about me. That's the way I've got the ill name of Chancery. I don't mind. I go to see my noble and learned brother pretty well every day when he sits in the inn. He don't notice me, but I notice him. There's no great odds betwixt us. We both grub on in a muddle. Hi, Lady Jane.
A large grey cat leapt from some neighbouring shelf on his shoulder and startled us all.
Hi, show him how you scratch. Hi, tear, my lady, said her master.
The cat leapt down and ripped at a bundle of rags with her tigerish claws, with a sound that it set my teeth on edge to hear.
She'd do as much for anyone I was to set her on,
said the old man.
I deal in cat skins, among other general matters, and hers was offered to me. It's a very fine skin, as you may see, but I didn't have it stripped off. That weren't like Chancery practice, though, says you.
Inspector Bucket and Snagsby in Tom All Alone's.
As they walk along, Mr. Snagsby observes, as a novelty, that however quick their pace may be, his companion still seems in some undefinable manner to lurk and lounge. Also, that whenever he is going to turn to the right or left, he pretends to have a fixed purpose in his mind of going straight ahead and wheels off sharply at the very last moment. Now and then, when they pass a police constable on his beat, Mr. Snagsby notices that both the constable and his guide fall into a deep abstraction as they come towards each other and appear entirely to overlook each other and to gaze into space. In a few instances, Mr. Bucket coming behind some undersized young man with a shining hat on and his sleek hair twisted into one flat curl on each side of his head, almost without glancing at him, touches him with his stick, upon which the young man, looking round, instantly evaporates. For the most part, Mr. Bucket notices things in general, with a face as unchanging as the great mourning ring on his little finger, or the brooch, composed of not much diamond and a good deal of setting, which he wears in his shirt. When they come at last to Tom All Alone's, Mr. Bucket stops for a moment at the corner and takes a lighted bull's-eye from the constable on duty there, who then accompanies him with his own particular bull's-eye at his waist. Between his two conductors, Mr. Snagsby passes along the middle of a villainous street, undrained, unventilated, deep in black mud and corrupt water, though the roads are dry elsewhere, and reeking with such smells and sights that he, who has lived in London all his life, can scarce believe his senses. Branching from this street and its heaps of ruins are other streets and courts so infamous that Mr. Snagsby sickens in body and mind, and feels as if he were going every moment deeper down into the infernal gulf.
"Draw off a bit here, Mr. Snagsby," says Bucket, as a kind of shabby palanquin is borne towards them, surrounded by a noisy crowd. "Here's the fever coming up the street."
As the unseen wretch goes by, the crowd, leaving that object of attraction, hovers round the three visitors like a dream of horrible faces, and fades away up alleys and into ruins and behind walls, and with occasional cries and shrill whistles of warning, thenceforth flits about them until they leave the place.
"Are those the fever houses, Darby?"
Mr. Bucket coolly asks, as he turns his bull's-eye on a line of stinking ruins. Darby replies that all them are, and further, that in all, for months and months, the people have been down by dozens, and have been carried out dead and dying, like sheep with the rot. Bucket, observing to Mr. Snagsby as they go on again, that he looks a little poorly, Mr. Snagsby answers that he feels as if he couldn't breathe the dreadful air. There is inquiry made at various houses for a boy named Joe. As few people are known in Tom All Alone's by any Christian sign, there is much reference to Mr. Snagsby, whether he means Carrots, or the Colonel, or Gallows, or Young Chisel, or Terrier Tip, or Lanky, or the Brick. Mr. Snagsby describes over and over again. There are conflicting opinions respecting the original of his picture. Some think it must be carrots, some say the brick. The kernel is produced, but is not at all near the thing. Whenever Mr. Snagsby and his conductors are stationary, the crowd flows round, and from its squalid depths obsequious advice heaves up to Mr. Bucket. Whenever they move, and the angry bull's eyes glare, it fades away and flits about them up the alleys and in the ruins and behind the walls, as before. At last there is a lair found out where Tuffy, or the tough subject, lays him down at night, and it is thought that the tough subject may be Joe. Comparison of notes between Mr. Snagsby and the proprietress of the house, a drunken face tied up in a black bundle and flaring out of a heap of rags on the floor of a dog hutch, which is her private apartment, leads to the establishment of this conclusion. Tuffy has gone to the doctor's to get a bottle of stuff for a sick woman, but will be here anon.
"And who have we got here tonight?"
says Mr. Bucket, opening another door and glaring in with his bull's-eye.
"Two drunken men, eh? And two women. The men are sound enough," turning back each sleeper's arm from his face to look at him. "Are these your good men, my dears?"
"Yes, sir," returns one of the women. "They are our husbands."
"Brickmakers, eh?"
"Yes, sir."
"What are you doing here? You don't belong to London?"
"No, sir. We belong to Hertfordshire."
"Whereabouts in Hertfordshire?"
"St. Albans."
"Come up on the tramp?"
"We walked up yesterday. There's no work done with us at present, but we have done no good by coming here, and shall do none, I expect."
"That's not the way to do much good,"
says Mr. Bucket, turning his head in the direction of the unconscious figures on the ground.
"It ain't indeed," replies the woman with a sigh. "Jenny and me knows it full well."
The room, though 2 or 3 feet higher than the door, is so low that the head of the tallest of the visitors would touch the blackened ceiling if he stood upright. It is offensive to every sense. Even the gross candle burns pale and sickly in the polluted air. There are a couple of benches and a higher bench by way of table. The men lie asleep where they stumbled down, but the women sit by the candle. Lying in the arms of the woman who has spoken is a very young child.
"Why, what age do you call that little creature?" says Bucket. "It looks as if it was born yesterday."
He is not at all rough about it, and as he turns his light gently on the infant, Mr. Snagsby is strangely reminded of another infant, encircled with light, that he has seen in pictures.
"He is not 3 weeks old yet, sir," says the woman.
"Is he your child?"
"Mine."
The other woman, who was bending over it when they came in, stoops down again and kisses it as it lies asleep.
"You seem as fond of it as if you were the mother yourself," says Mr. Bucket.
"I was the mother of one like it, master, and it died." "Ah, Jenny, Jenny," says the other woman to her, "better so. Much better to think of dead than alive, Jenny. Much better."
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Bleak House, read by Sean Barrett and Teresa Gallagher for Naxos Audiobooks.